Hello and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard. Today we'll be talking about collaboration between farmers, not only why it makes sense, but why people in this part of the world might resist the idea even if it does.
What we seem to have here kind of in Canada, and I would argue probably North America, is where we have more of an individualistic approach to our farm operation, where we feel the need to do it ourselves and not really rely on other farm operations to work together to achieve a common goal.
Also, we hear a lot of worrying these days about the use of facial recognition software and how Big Brother might be employing it to watch you. Fair enough, but what if you could put Big Brother to work, watching and monitoring your cattle instead?
It's the growth of the animal, it's the activity of the animal, it's health and welfare issues, it's nutrition.
We'll have all that, plus the latest from a volatile week in canola markets with Glenn Halleck of Markets Farm on Between the Rows after this.
Your soil has a unique story. At Decisive Farming by TELUS Agriculture, we get that. Start using precise nutrient information to get optimal crop performance. Try our variable rate program risk-free today. Visit decisivefarming.com. Conditions apply.
If you've ever pitched an idea and been told, oh, that will never work, our first guest can certainly relate, but he's taking the next step to find out why. He's an Ontario grain grower, sheep producer, and Newfield scholar who's just released a new report through that organization on the idea of collaboration between farmers. Now, if that seems like a pretty simple and straightforward idea to you as well, get ready to be told, ugh, that'll never work. Mark Brock is on the line from Hensel, Ontario, and he joins us now. Mr. Brock, hello and welcome to Between the Rows.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Now, first, let's talk about the idea for your report and how it came to be. This seems to me, like I said, to be a pretty relatable problem in farming. You know, a mid-sized farmer trying to pencil out a new combine.
Yeah, it's one of those things where equipment and technology has become more involved, the cost to really access that either equipment or technology has gotten to be kind of difficult. And as a mid-sized farm operation, which is kind of hard to define because I think everyone for the most part feels like a mid-sized farm, unless you're on either extreme of that. And what I just noticed on our own farm operation over the last, 5 to 10 years is that it was getting tougher to really justify some of those capital expenditures. And I was like, okay, well, if I'm having problem, probably other farmers are having the same issue. And it got me wondering if there was an appetite for farmers to work together to overcome some of those barriers. So you could have some of that newer technology and newer equipment on your farm operation. And you didn't have to face that kind of barrier of having enough, equity or economies of scale to do it, because you're able to maybe pool the job of a combine over a couple farms. So a couple farm operations. So it was kind of like this idea of like, how can we do it differently so that we're not kind of stuck in this rut of, well, if I want a combine, I got to buy it myself. Or if I want to put up a grain system, I got to do it myself. Why can't farmers work together to kind of meet a same end goal?
Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, here in Canada, collaborating on matters such as new equipment, is a relatively novel concept. I mean, if it wasn't, everybody would be doing it, and of course, this interview would be over before it started. how common is the idea of collaborating on these sorts of goals? How common is that idea elsewhere?
Well, in Canada, I'll just use some of the, since my report kind of got released yesterday, but I've been talking a bit about it with other people over the last kind of couple months because it was completed been kind of kicking the idea around with other farmers and people across Canada. And I've discovered there's actually a lot more collaboration happening around equipment than maybe I anticipated. But something I did see that was kind of really good examples of farmer collaborations were some of the stuff that was happening in Australia with farms there and research collaborations, peer group from business financial kind of helping each other figure out good financial ratios, actually doing joint ventures. And then New Zealand, I think everyone knows them very well for their dairy industry, but there was a lot of unique collaboration that was happening within the dairy sector there. So I wanted to take some time and travel there and just get a sense of, are they a little bit more open-minded to collaborations and what makes their collaborations, once start in the first place, but also seem successful versus what we seem to have here kind of in Canada, and I would argue probably North America, is where we have more of an individualistic approach to our farm operation, where we feel the need to do it ourselves and not really rely on other farm operations to work together to achieve a common goal.
Mm-hmm. You know, and now when I first read Lorraine Stevenson's article talking to you in Country Guide on your report, this whole idea really spoke to me. I mean, not that long ago, I was in the market for a new lawnmower, and I'm standing there looking at price tags. I'm wondering, why don't the neighbors and I get in on something like this together? Before I moved to this neighborhood, a few of my neighbors, went in together on a snowblower. That seems to work well for them, I'm standing there thinking of reasons all day long why I'd rather just, get my own mower. I don't want to be a bother to my neighbors. I don't want to, start pestering them for money. I don't want to be responsible for, wrecking, a jointly owned mower if something goes wrong while I'm using it, et cetera, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. I wouldn't hesitate to loan a neighbor my lawnmower, if his or hers broke. I wouldn't even mind cutting their grass if they needed help and my cord could reach. I don't consider myself some, rugged individualist, but, after reading Lorraine's article, I did wonder, am I just trying to, rationalize, something that's eminently sensible here?
Well, your story is very, very transferable to agriculture. I think when we see other farm operations struggle, if they need help with harvest or if there's been an accident and someone got hurt and they need some help to finish doing different jobs, all of us would be there in a heartbeat and we don't think twice about it. But when we start thinking about it from a day-to-day operation standpoint, we tend to not want to engage in those kind of activities. And I think it really speaks to human behavior. When you look at kind of some of the theories around economics and the psychology involved in economics and kind of how people go through a decision-making process around some of those things they have to purchase, it becomes very easy for us to rationalize why a process won't work or why a collaboration wouldn't work. If you take the combine example, it's like, well, whose field do we combine first?
Exactly.
If you look at even a peer group that maybe is looking at farm financial information sharing, there might be concern that, well, I don't want to give up my information because I feel I'm a better farm operator and I don't want to give my trade secrets away. Or some of it is even the fact that we actually don't have the self-confidence to share some of the information in peer groups, I do find, or research, because we might find out we aren't doing it quite as well as somebody else. So what it really speaks to, I find, is that there's this innate fear in human nature that we fear the loss of giving something up more than we can anticipate the gain or advantage we would have by doing something together. So, if you take your lawnmower example, which is a great one, is that, you're almost too afraid saying, well, I actually might want to cut my grass this Saturday, but two other neighbors want to at the same time, and I have a sporting event I want to go to, so I can only do it in this kind of time. So, I just don't want to have to deal with trying to schedule getting on my lawnmower. I'm just going to keep my own or have my own because I just want it to fit within my schedule, even though it's probably a simple process to overcome. And I think that's just some of it, is that as we make decisions on our farms, we have these biases and this human nature and emotional part of our mind that is always kind of influencing what would seem like a purely really good, simple economic decision. We're overanalyzing it to a certain degree and just applying emotion to it and making it kind of seem like it just won't work.
Mm-hmm. I mean, to sort of take the next step there. I mean, were there any actual bona fide practical or technical, actual genuine practical or technical reasons why the business models that you examined in your report wouldn't work here in Canada or in North America?
I think all of them would work. I think I identified kind of five case studies in my report where I looked at different kind of collaborations that are, some of them were very two farms that went together to form a joint venture and farm all their acres together now, to having small cooperative groups of farmers that actually, formed a co-op for research and information for their specific geographic region. I think all that stuff would apply here in Canada. I think what makes a collaboration really work is that the people that are involved in the collaboration or the ones that really have a burning desire to collaborate, when they find people to collaborate with, all those people tend to have a common why. They have a common goal. If you try to enter an equipment sharing thing, a deal, like if we try to share a combine with two farmers, if they don't have a common goal of why they're doing that, it's probably going to fail. And I think that's kind of what I talked to in my report as I kind of stepped through this journey of collaborations and seeing how some worked and how, you know, the odd one might have some hiccups in it because of some human elements in it. It just really spoke to me that if there's a really strong common why to the collaboration, then people tend to figure out how to make it work and they overcome the, you know, the human barriers to a collaboration.
Mm-hmm. Sort of eyes on the prize, as it were.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Now, these sorts of models, I mean, they do seem like a reasonable way to, you know, sort of spread out and mitigate, you know, the exposure to risk. You know, for all we talk about business risk management in farming these days, but you know, you do point out in your in the Country Guide article that that the policy framework we have here now in Canada does seem to focus on, you know, the individual farmer's cost, the individual farmer's return. You know, does this pose a problem in terms of getting Canadian farmers to think collaboratively, or is this just kind of a symptom of the bigger issue or the bigger problem?
But I think, you know, in my report, it's a question I pose because what we do have in Canada and especially in the United States as well is we have our suite of business risk management programs. I think in the U.S. last year, 40% of the farm income came to U.S. farmers came from pretty much government payments. There's been a lot of argument within our Canadian industry that our suite of programming maybe isn't all that great, but we do have a pretty good crop insurance program, I would argue, that's government funded to a certain level. What you see in Australia and New Zealand is they don't have that. They have zero government support. So there's really none of that government backstop. And so what I find, because of one of the, that kind of lack of government support, but two, the isolation that you see geographically with those two countries is that farmers there just really feel they need to rely on each other, because if they don't kind of work together, it's just going to be so much more of a so much more difficult. So when you talk to Australian farmers, they actually really view the world as their competitor, not their neighbor. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that in Canada, we tend to gravitate towards that thinking that our neighbors that farm are also our competitors. And I think that kind of gives us a bit of a mindset barrier to collaborations, because we haven't, you know, viewed our neighbor as someone that we could work with and even more successful if you pooled some resources, if there's an opportunity to do that.
Mm-hmm. And yet we wouldn't even hesitate to help our neighbors, as you said before, if there was a problem. I mean, when I was growing up, I mean, everybody would sort of bring their combines and help out the guy who wasn't quite finished yet. It was just something that everybody did.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have that in us. We're compassionate people, but when you get to the pure business side of it, and when you don't feel that need to be, I guess, kind of helpful, you tend to be individualistic. So I'm not sure, you know, if it's a problem. And I think, you know, individualism is really still very good, because I think even within a collaboration, if you bring individuals in that have different skill sets and different ways of thinking about things, that just makes a collaboration so much more effective, because you don't have, you know, a clone of five people there that all think the same way. So I think our individualism is good. I just think we need to kind of step outside and think about how can we farm differently? Is there opportunities for collaborations? Is there a really strong common why? And can you work with those people and kind of get through the human side of a collaboration to get to, you know, having a good structured collaboration that's going to be effective for both parties or all the parties involved?
Mm-hmm. Now, your report, as I said before, it's literally just out this week, yesterday, in fact, on the Newfield Canada website. You know, I don't want to get too much into it, because I'd really like people to read your report. And obviously, you'd like folks to read it. And of course, I'd also like folks to check out Lorraine Stevenson's article in the mid-March issue of Country Guide and then read your report. Yep. Now, what would you like to see come out of it now that the report is out there in the public eye?
So the goal of my report was, you know, if there was farmers that were interested or thought there was an opportunity to collaborate with somebody else or a couple groups of farmers, whether it's through a peer group or through equipment sharing or just even through a business joint venture project, I really wanted them kind of have a flow chart or a step-by-step process to think about how that collaboration what happened, trying to come up with a common why and make sure it's structured well. So I think my goal is that if there's farmers out there interested in the collaboration, hopefully they read my report and Lorraine's article to get a sense of what my report's about. And that, you know, maybe it's a, you know, can help them go through kind of a step-by-step guide about setting up their own collaborations.
Mm-hmm. Well, best of luck. And we're definitely looking forward to seeing your report out there and talking about this further in the future. Mr. Brock, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Mark Brock is a grain grower and sheep producer with Shepherd Creek Farms at Hensel, Ontario. He's a Newfield Scholar and former chair of Grain Farmers of Ontario. You can now find his report online at newfield.ca. That's N-U-F-F-I-E-L-D.ca. newfield.ca/scholars-reports. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard. So, true confession time. The other day, an email comes across my desk about identification technology for cattle, which I then dutifully forwarded to Glacier Farm Media's cattle editors, whether they have it or not, because that's just the kind of guy I am. Now, to that, I get a reply saying, essentially, well, you know, EID, that's all well and good. I'm all about the facial recognition software for cattle these days, to which I reply to myself, oh, that Lee Hart, what a joker. Turns out I hadn't yet read his column in the March 9th issue of Grain News, and he's serious, and there's a Canadian company out there that's even more serious about this idea. And to talk about that, we have Lee Hart, the editor for the Cattleman's Corner of Grain News, on the line. Lee, hi, and welcome back to Between the Rows.
Good. Well, good to be here, Dave. Thanks. Yeah.
Now, what is this company that's making facial recognition technology for cattle?
Well, they're... the first I've heard of them, but they're a company, I believe they're based out of Vancouver right now, although they have fairly strong ties or have had ties to Alberta and Western Canada. But the company is called OneCup AI, and which stands for artificial intelligence, not artificial insemination. And yeah, that's right. And but they're based out of Vancouver, and the principal is a husband and wife team, Jeff Shigmelsky and his wife Mocha. And now this is their baby here to come up with this. It's a little bit broader than facial recognition, but body recognition of livestock. And Mocha grew up in Alberta here, and her family is in the farming and ranching business here, so she's got ties there. And Jeff, he's been around for quite a few years in the software. He's one of the first guys that developed or created Facebook, not Facebook, sorry, internet. Connections here in Calgary. This goes back about 30 years. So
that was this CADvision?
CADvision, yeah. That's where I first connected, because when I first got internet, I signed up for CADvision, and it was Jeff Shigmelsky that was explaining to me how it worked. So anyway, so these are guys that, and I don't know if you a bit of background, Mocha explained to me that she was at a family barbecue one summer sitting around the campfire, and farmers and ranchers there. And, one of them said, you and Jeff are involved in the software business. It's too bad you couldn't come up with something to track cattle and help us monitor, cattle around the yard or out in pasture and that sort of thing. So that got the ball rolling. And so they put their heads together, and with a number of other advisors and geeks, I guess, came up with a program to do this recognition of livestock. Hopefully all types eventually, but they're just starting with cattle right now.
And the program is called Betsy, they said?
Yeah, the software that they've developed, just for a cute name, they call it Betsy whatever. And so that's the system that as a farmer or rancher that you'd have on your farm is a system called Betsy.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sure we've all read enough, of course, about the use of facial recognition technology for people in recent years. You know, just enough in my case to become, you know, super paranoid and twitchy about it. But for cattle now, I mean, are there enough unique distinctions in cattle faces? I mean, not just to tell two cattle apart, but to pick the right specific cow out of a crowded pen.
Well, it's a good question, and apparently so. You know, the first thing it does is the software. It's the program. It's a number of cameras. You have the farmer or rancher would get anywhere from 4 to 6 cameras, and then and mount them at different locations, and they would tie into the computer program, the software program. System. And the first thing the software does, as it sees an animal, now whether it's a mature animal or half mature or whatever, or a newborn calf, is decide if it recognizes that animal. And if it's never seen it before, it says, I don't know this animal, I'm going to give it a number. And as soon as it does that, it gives it a number, and it also takes a number of readings of the features of the creature that it sees, that the cameras see in front of it, sort of thing. So that's where it starts. And so every time it sees that one of the cameras sees this numbered animal, it does an update. It's scanning the animal all the time and provides some updates. So Mocha was telling me that, you know, when it was with human facial recognition, it's like 115 reference points that are monitored. And she said for what they've developed with this through OneCup AI, or what Betsy can do, is it monitors something like 530 some points on each animal. And that's not only the head, but it's also, all points of the body, obviously. So it's everything from ears to nostrils to eyeballs to hoofs to obviously color, you know, hair patterns and so forth. But, just anything and everything of the animal. So there's 500 and some different points that it'll measure. And so every time it, a camera sees an animal with that number, it updates, the imaging. And, she said, ideally, if it sees an animal every day, which is, you know, comes to the water hole or passes through a gate or something like that, I mean, it's going to update it every day. But as she said, ideally, it should be like, you know, not much more than once every, one or two weeks at the most, to be able to see an animal so it can do an update. But so that's how it, you know, it starts out with just giving the animal a number, and then every time it sees that number, walking past a camera, it does an update on, hundreds of different points of reference points on the body.
So even as the animal ages, then it could track a single animal and follow it along all the way from being a cute cuddly calf up to an ornery 1,000-pound cow if needed.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it just, that's, say, the number, I guess, is associated, primarily. I mean, I suppose if it loses an ear, I don't know what happens. It might drop an ear off the face, off the recognition, but every time it sees that animal that's associated with that number, it does an update, and it's right through until, it leaves the farm, or, it no longer is in front of the camera, I guess, anyway.
Now that's just wild to me. But now what's the practical value of this system? I mean, what would a mainline cattle producer use it for?
Well, that is just, the identification part is just, according to them, it's just sort of really the tip of the iceberg. And, we're talking about, or I talk to them in terms of, for the cow-calf producer in, Western Canada, how this is going to be used. They also said they develop it for a much broader sense than that. I mean, it's not just for farm use, although that's, important part, but it's, you know, it's ranchers, it's community pastures, veterinarians, auction houses, and feedlots are among the, you know, the potential customers who might want to monitor performance of cattle. So what else does it do other than identify an animal? Well, as the software, develops, and they're working on this. I mean, so it's not all ready at this one time, mm-hmm. but it's, but the idea is to monitor the, you know, obviously the, you know, the physical, characteristics of the animal, but, you know, it's, you know, I say it's quite a complex, service, if you want to call it that, but it's the growth of the animal, it's the activity of the animal, it's health and welfare issues, it's nutrition. So like on the growth, it'll, you know, pregnancy detection, the phenotype of the animal, whether the, you know, a newborn calf, whether it's, you know, nursing and getting its colostrum sort of thing. So, you know, it's anytime the camera can see the, you know, say if you've got a, I suppose, a calving pasture, and if you've got a camera out there and it's, you know, sees a calf being born, well, then it's going to monitor whether that calf, you know, is next thing, is that calf up and nursing and so forth. So, you know, and then, you know, it's going to monitor activity. Is the cow bonding with the calf? Socializing issues, how much walking it does, how much laying down it does, how much sleeping. You know, it's building this enormous record of, you know, what each individual animal is doing. And on, you know, health and welfare issues, it's, you know, it's going to measure respiratory, potentially it's going to measure the, you know, respiratory performance, lameness, inflammation, fever detection. Is going to have some, hopefully some, you know, infrared, you know, heat detection system to it, whether an animal looks depressed or not, you know, so yeah, it just, you know, it just goes on and on as say as what they, you know, potentially, they could develop the software to monitor. And, so all of this would be, you know, put into a file for this, each individual animal. And if it's, you know, it's somewhere in the, you know, in that, file, if you know, on any particular day, if the software feels there is a concern, it would send an alert to, you know, to the producer through his you know, smartphone or his laptop, and say, well, you know, this animal has got, you know, is showing some distress, or this animal is in, appears to be in heat, or this animal is lame or whatever. And so it's all this sort of you know, eyes in the field sort of thing that, that, the eventually will, you know, helping farmer with management of cattle. They don't have to be out there necessarily looking at everything, you know, themselves, the cameras will be monitoring them. So.
Very nice. Now, how far away is Betsy from being commercialized?
Well, they're pretty, I mean, I think they're pretty close with the, you know, with a prototype, you know, and say, Mocha was explaining they're this, I think it's this year, this fall, they're planning to have about 100, they're working with 100 cooperators, 100 producers to do, I guess it's called beta testing or whatever. And so they're going to mm-hmm. put these systems out there on 100 different farms or ranches in Western Canada, and just start to see how well it works. First of all, just with the identification, and I guess, you know, some basic tracking of animal behavior and that sort of thing. And then, you know, once that sort of is, gets to be, you know, I guess proven, then they'll, you know, then they'll start to add some of these other, you know, features as far as, you know, herd and health management and, you know, and activities and that sort of thing. So, so yeah, they're getting a start this year. And she said that they, you know, they have about 100 producers lined up. But she said, you know, if anyone's interested in being an early adopter, they're always interested in hearing from producers too. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the name of the company, again, for anybody who's looking for that, is One Cup AI, you said?
One Cup AI, and that's, yeah, and that's their website address, too, is just onecup.ai. And so they can Google that or, excuse me, search that, and, yeah, and just send them a note if you're if you want to be in on the ground floor of this livestock identification or its system, or broader than that, I guess. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I'll leave it there because I want everyone else to get caught up on reading your articles and columns as well, not just me. Lee Hart, thanks so much for your time today.
Well, you're more than welcome. That's good. Thanks, Dave. Good to be here.
Lee Hart is the editor of the Cattleman's Corner of Grain News Magazine in Calgary. You can check out his column on this topic and others online at grainnews, all one word with one N, .ca. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Dave Bedard. Well, the canola market had an interesting past week or so, just when it looked like ICE May canola might get comfortable up around the $800 per ton mark. It got knocked off that rather lofty little perch, but of course that's not the end of the story either. And to bring us up to date, we have Glenn Halleck here from Glacier Markets Farm. Glenn, hi, and welcome back to Between the Rows.
Well, thanks for having me again, Dave.
Always a pleasure. So why did canola take that tumble early last week? I don't remember hearing that anybody found a spare bazillion tons that they had sitting around over the
Yeah, with canola having been so high, you know, there's a great amount of contracts out there. People are looking to reap some profits from the high prices. And when there's profit taking, that brings prices down.
That's rather ironic. And here it is on Tuesday, March 23rd, as we speak, for anyone who's listening. And why has it been going back up again? I mean, the canola supply picture doesn't seem to have changed in the other direction either.
Yeah, this market is really volatile. You know, you look one moment, prices are in the green, and you come back 5 minutes later, everything's in the red, only to switch back. This morning, canola kind of started out, you know, with some small to moderate gains, and later on in the morning, steam was building. There were some really good gains, and I just looked a few minutes ago, and lo and behold, canola is down about $5 per ton on the May contract. Now, What's really strange about that is soy oil on the Chicago Board of Trade is up about 0.9 cents, which is really, really high. And usually when Chicago soy oil goes up, a canola follows. But today we have the total opposite.
And soy oil has actually been what's been supporting canola these past couple of days too, hasn't it?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Once in a while, canola will show some independent strength, you know, as it did when first the March contract and then the May contract broke that $800 per ton level. But, you know, for the most part, where soy oil goes, canola will follow.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about new crop canola prices? I mean, what do buyers and sellers know so far there?
Now, the market is still inverted. The old crop prices are still much higher than the new crop prices, but they're slowly inching their way. You know, eventually that inverse market will change. It's just a matter of a question as to when. The November and the January contracts were making some gains earlier today, but you know, like the old crop months, they're now falling back on Tuesday.
Now, are there any other reports coming up or any other data that's coming up that that we can keep an eye on that that also might be swinging prices one way or the other in the future?
Yeah, the two big things to watch for coming up on March 31st are USDA reports. One will be the USDA's projections for crop plantings this year. Right now, you look at some of the trade guesses, there's going to be more acres for wheat, corn, and soybeans. The other big report to watch for are the quarterly grain stocks reports from the USDA. I'm not sure what's going to happen there. You know, are we going to see once again stocks go lower, which would be a very bullish impact on the market? As for Canada, we won't see anything until sometime in April when Stats Canada produces their first projections of crops for this year.
Mm-hmm. And so these reports, these USDA reports, as you said, they're coming up March 31st. That's this coming. That'll be this coming Wednesday for anybody who's listening to this to this show, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So something to look forward to just ahead of April Fool's Day there. Glenn Halleck, thanks so much for your time today.
Well, thanks so much, Dave.
Glenn Halleck is a reporter for Glacier Markets Farm. And for those of you wondering where you can keep up on everything we just talked about, you can check out any of the Glacier Farm Media websites for daily market reports, and also get yourself set up if you want at marketsfarm.com. And that's our show for this week. I'd like to thank our guests, Mark Brock, Lee Hart, and last but certainly not least, Glenn Halleck. We'll be back in a week with more from the Glacier Farm Media family of publications. This has been Between the Rows, and I've been your host this week, Dave Bedard. Thanks again for listening.
Your soil has a unique story. At Decisive Farming by TELUS Agriculture, we get that. Start using precise nutrient information to get optimal crop performance. Try our variable rate program risk-free today. Visit decisivefarming.com. Conditions apply.